The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from AAA Go Magazine, The Washington Post, and National Geographic Traveler. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And as we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, it's going to be on two wheels as writer Katie McElveen helps us cycle through history. Now, her article is from the September-October 2018 issue of AAA Go magazine. So let us mount up and cycle through history. Perhaps better known for its high-speed autobahn than its meandering roadways, Germany is the ideal landscape to enjoy one of its son's inventions, the bicycle. A bit more than 200 years ago, inventor and aristocrat Carl von Drais mounted the two-wheeled, self-propelled vehicle he had invented and rode it from Mannheim, Germany, toward the town of Schwetzingen. He only made it 5 miles, about halfway, but his Laufmaschine, which lacked pedals and a drivetrain, was clearly a first step toward what would become known as the bicycle. There are lots of reasons to consider this part of southwestern Germany for a cycle trip. For one, the region is filled with neat villages, historic churches, tidy markets, and castles. There are atmospheric towns. Mannheim, Schwetzingen, and Heidelberg lie within easy striking distance of each other. You can cycle from one to the other in about an hour, opening up a cool journey that's accessible for even casual cyclists. Even better, local trains welcome cyclists, so you can base yourself in one city and return via rail instead of trail. And here's what you'll see along the way. First stop is Mannheim. Already a cultural center, Mannheim added to its offerings in June with a brand new building for its Museum of Contemporary Art, which holds a permanent collection of more than 2,000 works by Rodin, Manet, Cezanne, and other masters. Mannheim is also home to a Baroque palace where construction began in 1720. It's second only to Versailles in size, but contains one more window, the King Louis XV's gilded castle. Nearby, a large pedestrian shopping zone, Planken, is filled with boutiques, outdoor restaurants, and lively bars. Like the rest of the city, it's bike-friendly. The city's most iconic landmark, though, is its Art Nouveau water tower, which stands just under 200 feet tall and is surrounded by a park set with statues, fountains, and blooming gardens. Just across the street, a semicircular Friedrichsplatz is lined with cafes, wine bars offering outdoor seating, and overlooking the pretty scene. Schwetzingen. It took two generations of German rulers to transform a 17th century hunting lodge into this 178-acre wonderland that includes a massive Baroque-style palace, formal French garden, think boxwood hedges trimmed into complex swirls, shaded alleys, and burbling fountains, and a more relaxed English garden-style park. You'll need to dismount to explore the garden, but it's worth it. Clever paths lead to secret gardens tucked behind lush walls. A deep lilac-scented groves and an array of structures that include a deep grotto toppled by a temple of Apollo, an aviary, a frescoed marble-clad bathhouse, and a decorative mosque. During the 18th century, the castle and garden drew artists, musicians, and authors to the region, including Mozart, William Turner, Casanova, and Voltaire, who wrote part of Candide while in residence. Heidelberg is our next stop. Set along the banks of the Neckar River and hemmed by tall green mountains, Heidelberg offers a something-for-everyone mix. Boutiques, bars, and cafes are intermingled with churches dating back to the 12th century, medieval towers, traditional half-timbered houses, and a 230-year-old bridge topped by a pair of picturesque towers and a gate that have guarded the city since the Middle Ages. Towering above it all is Heidelberg Castle, a vast residential complex constructed and expanded between the 13th and 17th centuries, only to be destroyed by the French in 1689 and 1693. Despite its scars, though, the castle's grandeur remains. During the summer, its artfully crumbling facades and towers and grassy closes are used as stages and backdrops during some really unique festivals that are taking place almost year-round, and including the city's annual theater festival, and it's open to visitors all year long. But while Heidelberg is old, it isn't old-fashioned, thanks perhaps to the more than 30,000 students who attend Heidelberg University, which was founded in 1386 and infuses the city with a youthful vibrancy. Don't miss a visit to the Katzer, which from 1778 until 1914 served as a short-term jail for unruly students who had committed offenses such as public drunkenness and livestock theft. The walls and ceilings of each cell are decorated with poems, silhouettes, and other graffiti created by the incarcerated students. Cycle paths wind through the city along with the river and into the, rather along the river and into the mountains, where you can ride to a number of high altitude lookouts. So there you go, some fun in southwest Germany. Well, we're going to return to the USA, where Washington Post writer Jim Webster takes us on a tour of Havre de Grace, Maryland, as the headline reads in the June 22, 2018 issue. In Havre de Grace, Maryland, on the Chesapeake Bay, a rich maritime history, and ducks, lots of ducks. Because Washington sits at the southwest end of the Northeast Corridor, anyone with interest in the upper reaches of the zone can spend a lot of time traversing the same path back and forth over and over. By car or by train, and regardless of the destination, the scenery is a parade of monotony. That's true for almost the entire journey. Almost. For a brief moment, the tunnel vision created by concrete canyons or wooded walls fades. When you cross the bridge over the Susquehanna River, just east of Baltimore, everything opens up into a classic estuary view at the spot where the river and the Chesapeake Bay each begin or end, depending on your perspective. Catch it at the right time of day, and it looks like an inspirational meme waiting to happen. Just snap a photo and add a quote dripping with forced sentimentality. You're passing through Havre de Grace. What I wanted to find out is what it looks like at less than 70 miles per hour. Duck culture. As I drive into the downtown area, it's a gray, drizzly day, the kind of day that clichés suggest are great if you're a duck, and that's perfect because I head directly to the Decoy Museum on the city's waterfront. The first thing I learn is that this area is a migration pattern and has a long history of duck hunting. The fact that duck hunters need decoys made it natural that the region would spawn experts in the craft. Even if you're not a duck hunter, it's easy to appreciate the displays as folk art. In fact, with the advent of mass production and the decline of duck hunting, many of the more recent examples are made for decorative purposes. But a large part of the museum acts as sort of a hall of fame, honoring the local legends of the craft. Chief among them is R. Madison Mitchell, who wore a bow tie to his shop every day and is estimated to have made more than 100,000 decoys in his career. He started in 1924, selling them for $1.25 each, which translates to about $18 in today's economy, and developed a wet-on-wet painting technique that was a really big deal in certain circles of his era. You can also see the work of Jim Pierce, Jim Currier, and Bob McCall, who introduced the duplicating lathe to the process, which made mass production possible. There are a number of other museums also dedicated to facets of the city's maritime history, and the next one I walk to is the Lock House Museum, where there's a working scale model of a lock to illustrate how boats used to navigate the elevation changes as they made the trip up or down the Susquehanna back in the days when the river was the most efficient highway through the city. The docent tells us the river's canal was the country's busiest until the Erie Canal opened. He sounds a little upset about the fact it was overtaken. This canal ceased operations in about 1900. He definitely wasn't there, but it seems like he might still be taking it personally. I appreciate that level of civic dedication. After we watch the model run through its paces, our guide invites us to go outside and see a restored portion of the old canal. As I walk out, a family of geese made it clear that they're claiming the area around the lock and we aren't welcome to come any closer. The largest of them, there are two adults and maybe 10 younger ones that seem to be in an awkward juvenile stage, is loudly insistent about it. It, male, female, I have no idea, stares me down and shoots me a pretty menacing glare. I was just at the Decoy Museum, so I kind of understand why it might have a beef with me, and I decide to reverse history in my own small way and just let them hold their ground. pronunciation guide. It's worth talking about how to pronounce the name of the city. I ask everyone I meet, and it's almost unanimous. They all seem to have their own way of saying it. The city was named for, or rather by, the Marquis de Lafayette in the days of the Revolution because it reminded him of the port city in France and translates to Harbor of Mercy. If you speak French, you might insist that it be pronounced something like Radigrois, with no small degree of drama inflected on the syllable of your choosing. I couldn't find anyone who says it like that. The GPS app that directed me here is pretty certain it's Havre de Grace, which is consistent with just how wrong it usually is about such things. You might hear someone drop a Havre de Grace, which suggests they are of a certain age. Others run it together if it's all one word, Havre de Grace, or Havre de Grace. Some slight variations of Havre de Grace or Havre de Grace are most prevalent in my totally unofficial survey. And those fit nicely with American phonics. Francophiles may find that gauche, but when I check in at the Chamber of Commerce, I'm assured that however you want to say it is fine. They know what you mean. Slowing it down. Given the speed with which I usually pass through Havre de Grace, it seems that a leisurely walk through the city is in order, and there are plenty of viable itineraries. The downtown area runs along Washington Street south from Rocambeau Plaza, and antique malls are a recurring attraction. There's one in an old cannery that once was the center of industry here, one with an old Pyrex cookware, one dedicated to old postcards, another with extensive second-floor collection of beer cans. Curation takes many forms. For history buffs, there's the Lafayette Trail, a 3-mile loop through the city which stops at relevant old spots and structures. For my purposes, I walk up and down the promenade a couple of times. The 3/4-mile boardwalk stretches along the water's edge from the city's signature Concord Point Lighthouse down to a marina, all the while giving you an unobstructed view of the horizon over the Chesapeake, which is even more serene when you aren't looking at it from a window at 70 miles an hour. I turn to face north, sit down, and spend a not short period of time staring at the bridges across the water just a bit up the Susquehanna, and I'm perfectly happy to do it at exactly 0 miles per hour. Writer Jim Webster has been a multi-platform editor at the Washington Post since 2012. He's also a cookbook author. Now, if you'd like to go to Havre de Grace and say it any way you please, how about where to stay? Well, there's Vandiver Inn at 301 South Union Street. Check them out online at vandiverinn.com, V-A-N-D-I-V-E-R, vandiverinn.com. The 18-room downtown bed and breakfast was built in 1886 by Maryland politician Mary Vandiver as a wedding present to his wife, and it remains a popular venue for weddings. Its communal areas encourage guests to socialize. Rooms have king or queen beds, and specials start at about $130 per night. How about where to eat? Well, there's Vintage Cafe at 114 North Washington Street. Check it out online at VintageCafeHDG.com, VintageCafeHDG.com. While the whole town evokes a sense of nostalgia, this mother and daughter-run diner actively would make you feel like you were in an extra in a black-and-white sitcom if the room wasn't so orange. Look for standard breakfast and lunch options in large portions. Your server might highly recommend the cheesy potato side dish and deliver it with a friendly admonishment that it's a splurge you shouldn't have every day. Lunch entrees from $6.50, breakfast a la carte options from $2.50. And then there's Lagom, 209 North Washington Street, online at lagomhdg.com, L-A-G-O-M, lagomhdg.com. Many of the restaurants in the city specialize in a crab-centric menu you would expect of any place in the water of Maryland, and some of these are here too. But after getting the rundown on the city's connection to waterfowl, I targeted this place because there was a duck on the menu, When you mention Lagom around the town, expect to hear a glowing report about their signature Buffalo Brussels sprouts, entrees from $12. How about what to do? Well, the marinas at 723 Water Street is where you'll start, and you can get more information about this area, hdgmarinecenter.com. That's hdgmarinecenter.com. If you want to get out of the water, this is the place to rent a Get out on the water. This is the place to rent a kayak, starting at $40 for 3 hours, or a stand-up paddleboard is $30 for 2 hours. This is also the home of the Black-Eyed Susan, a 111-foot-long paddle-wheel boat that's mostly reserved for private charters, but it does some public cruises. And then our next stop could be the Havre de Grace Decoy Museum. They're at 215 Giles Street, and it's decoymuseum.com online. That's decoymuseum.com. Havre de Grace considers itself the decoy capital of the world, and this is where they celebrate the craft. You'll read about the history, see examples, and learn about the masters. And on weekends through the summer, the museum hosts decoy makers in the shop out back, which once belonged to R. Madison Mitchell. The shop was relocated to the museum and includes a life-size likeness of him still working away. Tickets, $6, seniors, $5, children ages 9 to 18, $2, and younger are free. Tours also available and cost $3 to $4. Then there's the Susquehanna Museum at the Lock House at 17 Conesteo Street. That's spelled C-O-N-E-S-T-E-O, 817 Conesteo Street. Or you can check it out at thelockhousemuseum.org, thelockhousemuseum.org. It's worth more than the price of admission. It's free to see the working model of a Susquehanna and Tidewater canal lock, raise or lower a tiny barge, and have the canal's early economic importance passionately explained. And then there's the Bahakas Antique Mall, 408 North Union Avenue, and you can check it out at bahakas.com, B-A-H-O-U-K-A-S, bahakas.com. There's a huge collection of classical toys, local sports memorabilia, old postcards, and artwork from vintage vegetable cans. Canning was a big thing in this town back in the day. And if you drink beer, walk upstairs and gawk at the stockpile of cans and brewed branded relics. For more information about Havre de Grace, check out explorehavredegrace.com, and that's explore, H-A-V-R-E, Havre, D-E, Grace, G-R-A-C-E, havredegrace.com, explorehavredegrace.com. Lots of fun there, just outside of Baltimore, so that would be fun too, huh? All right, well, let's head up the East Coast and take a road trip through coastal Maine. Our writer and guide is going to be Gina DiCaprio Versace. Her article, found in the August-September 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. And it begins with a few little side highlights. The number of miles involved is 130, days on the road 7, Blue Ribbon Blueberry Pie, 2 Fat Cakes Bakery in Portland. That's our quest, I guess. And then hike. Well, you can hike all you want at the Rachel Carson National Wildlife Refuge. Rugged shores, classic coastal towns, and lobster rolls washed down with hoppy local beer. This is Maine's late summer perfection, the micro-season, when the pine tree state shines. It's when the water is warmest and the wild blueberries are ripest for the picking. Last August, the Maine Sea Grant, along with the state's Tourism Bureau and aquaculture industry, launched the Oyster Trail of Maine to promote the burgeoning bivalve scene, which stars the Crassostrea virginica variety. But even if the idea of slurping down an oyster makes you feel squeamish, following the trail of Maine's mighty mollusks leads to plenty of memorable spots. Unlike the remote northwestern parts of the state, where unmarked logging roads and vast swaths of impenetrable backcountry reign supreme, in coastal Maine, the world is actually your oyster. Motoring along Route 1 from the southern beaches to the mid-coast delivers a hefty dose of vintage oceanside charm. Along the way, smaller roads that beg for a detour dip to the sea. Here, old salts haul traps on working waterfronts, and roadside sandwich boards hawk just-caught lobsters. Along with these colorful nautical traditions, you'll find a forward-thinking spirit. So go ahead, catch the spirit, and hit the road. Well, let's see what we've got here in our first stop. Well, we're going to get campy, according to Gina. Famous as a favorite seaside retreat for the well-heeled and the summer playground of former President George H.W. Bush and family, Kennebunkport epitomizes New England Nautical Charm. Roll up to the Sandy Pines Campground, where 16 safari tents, each decked out in lavish style by a local interior designer, offer a plush but nostalgic outdoor experience. On-site amenities, including a classic general store and the Icicle Tricycle delivering old-fashioned ice cream bars, make the place feel like a beachy Mayberry. Stop number two, the Accidental Farmer. 10 years ago, Abigail Carroll was living in Paris, trading stocks and dating a French count. Now she spends her days on the Scarborough River, where she runs Nonesuch Oysters. Climb aboard the farm skiff for a breezy jaunt to the oyster beds, keeping an eye out for puppy-faced harbor seals along the way. Then peek at baby bivalves in the oyster nursery before tossing back a few Abigail pearls or Nonesuch emeralds. At stop three, it's Coastal Digs. Though rocky shores dominate Maine's coastline, a mile-long swath of sand frames the inn by the sea in Cape Elizabeth. Follow the boardwalk through a sanctuary planted with native vegetation to lovely Crescent Beach. The six-acre oasis is part of an initiative to create a safe haven for vulnerable New England cottontail rabbits. The inn also works with the Animal Refuge League of Portland to support dog adoption. Be prepared, there's almost always a cutie curled up behind the front desk. Stop number four, the City of Suds. The Portland area abounds with breweries, some 28 out of them, according to the Maine Brewers Guild. In the city's hip East Bayside neighborhood, five joints churn out everything from beer to cider, mead, spirits, kombucha, and in the case of Urban Farm Fermentory, even gruet, an old-style beer brewed with backyard botanicals. Pop into the shop, a seafood-centric eatery for Maine oysters, and, of course, beer. Stop number five, Boot Up. In 1911, motivated by his distaste for cold, wet feet, outdoorsman Leon Wood Bean created the Maine Hunting Shoe. Today, a 16-foot replica of the iconic duck boot presides over L.L. Bean's flagship store in Freeport and serves as the perfect prop for a road trip photo. Forgot to bring a sleeping bag, a lobster pot, a leash for Fido. You'll find all three among the wares spread throughout the 7-acre retail campus. Christen your togs with a hike in nearby Wolf's Neck Woods State Park. Number six is Milling Around. Indie films, live music, and rotating exhibitions all have a home at Brunswick's Fort Andros Mill, a cotton mill turned community hub on the banks of the Androscoggin River. The mill also houses the Brunswick Flea Market on Saturdays. Grab a latte from the coffee bar and head out for a stroll. Back in the day, mill workers from the neighboring Topsham crossed the river using the Androscoggin Swinging Bridge, which now connects to the scenic Androscoggin River Walk. Work up an appetite, we'll head to the Asian-scented Tao Xuan, whose chef-owned Sarah Stadler has been a semi-finalist for James Beard Rising Star Chef of the Year award 5 times. And stop number seven, Ship Shape. When that first Maine winter proved too cold for comfort, settlers of the 1607 Pockham Colony built a boat to take them back across the river. That vessel, Virginia of Sagadoc, earned nearby Bath the right to call itself the birthplace of the American shipbuilding. Visit the Virginia's in Progress replica at the Bath Freight Shed, where shipbuilders work Wednesday through Saturday in the town's manufacturing heyday. 22 shipyards line the Kennebec River, including the Bath Iron Works, which still makes vessels for the U.S. Navy. Get the full backstory and board a river cruise at the Maine Maritime Museum. On to stop number eight on the half shell. As with wine, an oyster's flavor profile reflects the characteristics of its growing environment. The protected waters of the Demerara-Scotta River help make it the Napa Valley of oysters, and many of Maine's best-loved farms sit along the shore. For a glimpse into Demerara-Scotta's thriving community, take a oyster ecology tour with Midcoast Kayak. Across the river, Shuck Station serves a selection of local oysters nestled on a bed of ice. Stop number nine, we have an art crawl. The giant Eat on Rocklands Main Street may signal food, but the exhibits beneath it in the Farnsworth Art Museum deliver nourishment of another variety. Created by Robert Indiana, best known for his love sculptures, this sign makes an appropriate icon for a town with more than 20 galleries and museums. Art buffs will also appreciate 250 Maine, a boutique hotel with rotating displays of creations by local artists. And Stop 10, come about. Midcoast Maine's sparkling Penobscot Bay is often studded with sailing vessels, many based in Camden's harbor. Snap up a carry-all made from recycled Maine sailcloth at the Seaback Shop, then cast off on a sunset cruise complete with live music and sweet treats aboard the 100-year-old schooner Surprise. If you have 4 or 5 extra days, set sail on a Maine Windjammer Association historic schooner, which stops at a deserted island for a classic lobster bake. Ooh. Well, since we're already in the colder clime of the north, shall we let writer Kristen Pope lead us on a great escape to Manitoba? This article published in the August-September 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. And it begins with Wild Nights and Northern Lights. Churchill calls itself the polar bear capital of the world, a gateway to the Arctic. This tiny Manitoba town, 600 miles north of the provincial capital, Winnipeg, sits on the remote western shore of Canada's Hudson Bay, an adventure and nature destination where tundra, boreal forest, and the waters of Hudson Bay meet. The area has been a traditional hunting zone for indigenous peoples, whose heritage is honored at Churchill's Isintak Museum, formerly the Eskimo Museum. Today, the region attracts visitors from around the world with its opportunities to watch wildlife and view auroras. In the 1970s, Churchill resident Len Smith created the Tundra Buggy, allowing visitors to get closer to polar bear habitats. After a National Geographic crew joined him, their coverage of the region prompted wildlife enthusiasts to make tracks to view bears and belugas. Summer, fall, and winter are the seasons to visit. Book your flights early, as Churchill currently is accessible only by plane. Whenever you come, count on catching one of nature's best shows. And let's take a look at some of these shows by season. In the summer, the beluga whales. Nearly 60,000 beluga whales inhabit the western reaches of Hudson Bay each summer. Thousands head into the mouth of the Churchill River in search of warmer waters to birth, raise calves, and feast on capelin and other fish. Highly sociable and curious cetaceans, belugas are called canaries of the sea for their bird-like calls. Boat tours bring visitors to waters that belugas often frequent. Many boats have hydrophones so passengers can listen to the whales underwater. Adventurous visitors eager for up-close looks can kayak, paddleboard, or snorkel. Fun fact, unlike most whales, belugas don't have fused neck vertebrae, allowing them to turn their heads to look back at you. In the fall, it's polar bears. One of the best ways to spot Ursus maritimus, the polar bear, is on a tundra vehicle tour through the Churchill Wildlife Management Area and beyond. The rugged vehicles transport visitors into this realm of the ice bear to watch male spar cubs play and mother snooze. Helicopter tours provide a bird's-eye view of the sparkling vistas of snow, ice, and water, along with plenty of bear sightings. Normally, it's ill-advised to walk among the bears, but Churchill Wild offers hiking tours at remote ecologists to see them safely by foot. Come fall, bears begin to gather along Hudson Bay, waiting for ice to form so they can hunt seals. A prime time to see these magnificent animals. And then there's the winter. And what do we have in winter? None other than the Northern Lights. Churchill is one of the top places on Earth to witness the Aurora Borealis, which shimmers into curtains of light here some 300 nights a year. February and March, with their dark and clear evening skies, provide ideal viewing conditions. Green Northern Lights are most common. Red and blue are more elusive. Temperatures this far north typically are frigid midwinter, but aurora watchers waiting for the polar spectacular to fan out over the heavens stay warm in tent-sized aurora domes, a wheeled aurora pod, and even an aurora lounge. Photography tours offer visitors guidance on capturing images in this fleeting phenomenon with tips on how to optimize your camera settings. Wow. And they've got one picture someone took of the aurora, and it's quite spectacular with a lot of purples and other shades and hues mixed in. Well, that's going to do it for today's edition of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it, that you'll listen next time and join us. I'm Mike Edwards. I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, reminding you our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.